This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. April 22, 2010 was the 40th anniversary of Earth Day. Today we celebrate this last week of what's been known as Earth Month in April with a show on the theme of Earth Day. We're going to explore issues that relate to living in harmony with the limited resources that Earth provides. I have pieces from the 2008 Idaho Environmental Summit and the 2010 Earth Day celebration in Lewiston, Idaho. The topics today range from forests, forest products, and land use and development to conservation and how we relate to the land. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Today's show is all about Earth Day. I start the show with Yin Radio's associate producer from last year, Renee Pope. Renee is a student at the University of Idaho, and she made an Earth Day poster for a class. The poster was entered in the LC Recyclers Earth Day Poster Contest in Lewiston, Idaho, for this 40th birthday of Earth Day. I ran into Renee Pope there. So I'm here at the Lewis Clark Recyclers Earth Day celebration. I'm talking to Renee Pope, who you might know from previous Yin Radio shows.
Hello.
Renee entered the Earth Day Poster Design Contest. It's a Department of Art and Design class project, and they designed these, what size are they?
They're 24 by 36 posters.
Yeah, in full color, very professional work. Come over and talk to me about your poster, if you would.
Okay.
So, first of all, I'll describe it. It's a close-up of some flower petals. They're beautiful colors of reds, oranges, yellows. It's one flower, though.
Yes, one flower. It's pretty much a photo from underneath the flower, and the sun is shining through like little gaps between the petals. So,
tell me how you came to this concept.
Well, I knew I wanted to use something very simple, do something simple, and I wanted to use flower. So I just kind of searched all over online and I found this image. So it's really a simple poster, probably the simplest one out of everyone that's made. It's really just the photo, and then I cropped it to the correct size and I just put on the type. It says Earth Day, April 22nd, and then my tagline says, "Good planets are hard to find."
Now, why did you choose to go simple, as opposed to some of these are very complicated?
Yeah. It's just my aesthetic. I prefer clean lines, straight. I think sometimes some of these can get too busy, kind of take over what it's about.
You know, I guess a common theme on Earth Day logos and posters is, of course, the view from space, Earth from space. But you chose a flower. Why does that say Earth to you?
Well, because I wanted it to send a happy message, you know, not like we're destroying the earth. And there are still beautiful things on the earth, and flowers are beautiful. I think we'd all agree to that. So that's why. And the sun makes everything more pretty. So.
Well, it is a beautiful poster.
Well, thank
really
you.
Is. And I also enjoy the simplicity.
Oh, good.
Thank you very much, Renee.
Okay, thank you.
That was Renee Pope talking about her poster for Earth Day. Installment number two comes to us from the 2008 Idaho Environmental Summit. It was held in Boise and hosted dozens of speakers from industry, government, and environmental organizations. Catherine Goldman was there. She talked about her work for the Wood River Land Trust in Blaine County, Idaho. Catherine Goldman does wetland restoration, working along the Wood River. She tells us why and how the Wood River Land Trust is making it all happen.
My name is Catherine Goldman, and I'm a staff member for the Wood River Land Trust. Real quickly, if you don't know exactly what we do, the Land Trust protects and restores land, water, and wildlife habitat in the Wood River Valley and its surrounding areas. And we do that by working collaboratively and cooperatively with local communities and landowners. Because I work primarily on protecting the Big Wood River, as a staff person at the Wood River Land Trust, imagine that, I would like to use one stretch of the Big Wood River to frame my talk today. I'll tell you a little bit about the tools we use in our work and share with you some of what our organization has learned regarding municipal and agency collaboration and the successful passage of a levy for conservation in Blaine County. We use primarily three different tools to protect the Big Wood River and to achieve our mission. Conservation agreements, also known as voluntary land protection agreements or conservation easements. We work to acquire land to create Wood River Land Trust preserves, and we also conduct restoration projects primarily along the Big Wood River. In this slide, you'll see that we've used on this stretch of the river all three of these methods for land and water conservation. Right here is one of the more recently completed conservation agreements with a private landowner stretching along almost 3/4 of a mile of the Big Wood River right against the city limits of Haley. And the second half of that easement, it's actually two separate easements bisected by the river. The last portion of that was just completed in 2008. And this is our land trust preserves, property that the Wood River Land Trust owns and protects in perpetuity. And then the pink areas you'll see here, there's one that stretches along the banks of the river. There's one just upstream from that across the road. There's a project area here, and then a fourth one here. These are all restoration projects that have been completed along the Big Wood River. So we used all these methods in this stretch of the river, and these efforts, such as the preserves and the restoration projects, have added greatly to the more traditional methods of working with easements with private landowners. And these restoration projects here in pink, we have primarily focused our collaborative work with the city of Haley. One of these projects, the northernmost one, is on private land, but the rest of them are on municipal property. This piece right here, it's kind of a triangular piece that butts directly up against our Draper Wood River Preserve, is a municipal park owned by the city of Haley called Lyons Park, and this is another municipal park owned by the city of Haley. And let me tell you real quickly a little bit about our philosophy in working with the municipality on these restoration projects. We work on city property in collaboration with the city of Haley because we believe that we should seize the opportunities we have in front of us when they come up to bolster and add to the conservation we do with private landowners. And were we to ignore the land use patterns along the river here, we would be ignoring a pretty large landowner in a stretch of a river of the river that has been identified by one of our studies on the river, a geomorphic assessment of the Big Wood River that we completed in 2006, that showed that this stretch of river was one of the highest priority areas for protection and for restoration. This area has some of the better restoration potential in the valley. So we have actually worked with the city of Haley on these separate projects because we believe that we can get more bang for our buck that way. And I'll talk a little bit more about the funding partnerships that are in place for that. The other reason that we work with the city of Haley is that these properties and the one on private property are very popular river access spots. This is where people go and get down to the river and go swimming, walk their dog, go tubing, things like that. These are the places that people get to know the Big Wood River, and we want people to be able to come on to the Draper Wood River Preserve from an area that's healthier and better than it is today. I'll tell you a little bit about some of the projects. The slides you're looking at here are a before and after photograph of a restoration that we completed in 2008. This is the Croy Wetland Restoration Project. And it's a good example of all the other projects. All of those projects in cooperation with the City of Haley were funded in part with 319 water quality grant funding from the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality. And that grant program pays for 60% of the project costs with a 40% required match. In this project at Croy, Lyons Park is actually the site of the city of Haley's former municipal landfill. And we came in to an area that looked much like this throughout the project area, denuded of vegetation, completely, entirely compacted and full of old municipal waste, and removed over 1,200 tons of fill, concrete, garbage, and glass, things like old hot water heaters, bed springs, household waste, essentially, and took that out and replanted the area with native shrubs, native trees, and native grasses. And you can kind of see it's late in the day there, but the grass is coming in. There's some new cottonwood trees and red osier dogwoods and other native species that we've put in there. And this parcel of land is a very large wetland complex. So this fill and garbage was stacked right up against one of the nicest wetland resources in our valley that's publicly accessible. That gets back to what I was talking about earlier, about trying to create a nice point of access for some of our premier resources along the Big Wood River's floodplain. The funding match, 40% of the funding match, came through project partners like the City of Haley, because this was their property, Blaine County, the Blaine County Flood District, Wood River Land Trust staff time, the Idaho Association of Soil Conservation Districts, and volunteer time, as well as some private donors. One of the important parts of this project is the kind of the mutual benefits, not only the actual improvement to this former landfill in terms of the improved water quality, wildlife habitat, and enhanced floodplain function, but the improved status of the property that the City of Haley gets back from us. And we see this as a great investment and a way to influence long-term the land use patterns along this stretch of river, which we've identified as so important to the future of the Big Wood River and its healthy fishery. An example of that would be for approximately 3 years, it's usually 3 years that we structure an agreement like this with the cities. When we do the project for three growing seasons thereafter, we do things like go out and make sure our temporary irrigation system that we have in place there is working and monitor how much water the plants are getting and when to dial back to basically mimic more natural conditions as the plants get their roots in. And we maintain the area for weeds. And when the city takes management back over, because after all it is their property, they inherit a project that's in good shape, and that reflects well on the land trust, and it also incentivizes them to continue to maintain a project like that and continue to work with us on future projects, essentially. It's kind of a win-win situation because, as you can see, we've done multiple projects. We also like to think about, although it's not a traditional conservation easement work, it's something that, again, we're building that the kind of public use that generates that connection with the land that then builds on the work we've done there to increase community support for floodplain and wetland protection throughout the community in future projects. This year, we also participated, the Wood River Land Trust participated in a local effort to protect land, water, and wildlife through a ballot measure to create a dedicated fund for conservation in Blaine County. Proposition 1 passed in this year's November election, and it will generate $3.4 million over 2 years. It's a two-year serial levy, so it expires after 2 years. And it's the first countywide measure for conservation to pass in Idaho. One real important part of this, this levy is that it has a citizens advisory board that will make recommendations on the types of projects that will receive funding, and those recommendations will go to the Board of County Commissioners. So real quickly, I'd like to tell you a little bit about how we passed this levy and a few of the lessons learned. And real important up front to say that the levy can be used for acquisition, outright purchase of property, for permanent protection, purchase of conservation easements, agricultural or conservation, for wildlife habitat and water quality protection, and it can also be used to purchase water rights. The build-up to this levy was to do a lot of research on what types of measures would be approved by the voters in our county. And we got together with the Trust for Public Land and did that. And when I say we, I mean a coalition of organizations. The Land Trust participated in a group of organizations that included our local smart growth group called Citizens for Smart Growth, Idaho Smart Growth, the Nature Conservancy, and the Idaho Conservation League, as well as the Trust for Public Land. Trust for Public Land helped us all conduct this polling, and we researched what would work, what type of measure, also how much people were willing to pay in Blaine County to do this, to create a dedicated fund for conservation. And we also gauged the interest of our commissioners. The commissioners had to refer this to the ballot, so our county commissioners had to say, yes, guys, we think it's a good idea. And they did. So the polling showed very strong support for this type of measure, a two-year serial levy, with a moderate kind of financial dollar tag. $3.4 million in Blaine County is not going to buy a ton of land, but I'll get more to that later. After that, after the polling showed, yes, it's a good idea, go forward, we worked with the County Commission on referring the measure to the ballot, and formalized, once that measure was referred to the ballot, formalized our groups of organizations into a ballot committee that then hired a campaign manager and committed to working on ensuring that this measure passed with a simple majority, 50% plus one, at the ballot in November. Our campaign manager and the steering committee, which I served on, conducted press to get the word out. We secured endorsements from businesses and private individuals and local elected officials and community leaders. We sent out three different direct mail pieces to voters in the county, and we made thousands of voter contacts through phoning 2 to 3 times a week for many weeks. That was actually pretty fun. We also worked with the commission on a resolution that would tell local citizens exactly how and where their funds would be spent. And you can see this map here, Vote Yes on Prop 1, shows the different areas. The blue is the Big Wood River corridor. The kind of reddish color is a portion of the Little Wood River watershed. And then this green area is the south end of what's known here as the Bellevue Triangle. And that is an area that has a lot of very special wetland wildlife habitat, agricultural land still in production in Blaine County. And it also happens to be the designated sending area for Blaine County's Transferable Development Rights Program, which is in its infancy. After that resolution was passed by the County Commission, we worked diligently on getting out the vote, contacting all of the people who we initially did voter ID with, who said, yes, I want to support Prop 1, and making sure they went to the polls on November 4th. And the measure passed by 53%, so good on us. Not quite a squeaker, but in this economy, we were pretty happy. And this levy, now that it's in place, this levy can help the county to stretch our local dollars, this $3.4 million over 2 years, to turn that into double that figure, triple that figure through attracting state, federal, and other state funding that requires a match. And this fund will also help, we hope, as the Citizens Advisory Board kind of works towards what this program can be, this levy fund will help jumpstart the county's transferable development right program in this area of the county to send those development rights up to the receiving area where those development rights could actually be developed, and to ensure that we protect our unique wetland complex down there for all the ducks and other birds and other wildlife that use the area, and to protect our agricultural heritage in Blaine County. And that an important component of that may be the development of a transferable development rights bank to actually place a value on a transferable development right. Right now, we're not exactly sure how much a transferable development right is worth in Blaine County. And but we do have our first subdivision certified with transferable development rights. So we, this could be a really important step for Blaine County's future growth. Some of the lessons we learned working on Proposition 1 include, we should have started a little earlier getting the measure on the ballot. Number of things conspired against us for that, but that we would, if we had it to do over, we would have started a little bit earlier. It would have given us more time to work in the community, to spread the message and to make presentations to community organizations and other leadership types of groups like Rotary and things like that. We did some of that, but we definitely could have done more, and we could have bumped our percentage up in terms of the passage of the levy if we had more time. Because our county is so rural, we decided to do voter ID entirely through phoning. And what we learned is that we wouldn't do that again. In the future, we would probably work with some kind of combination where we would likely target specific precincts to walk for one-on-one voter ID. Because, let me tell you, nobody answers their phone anymore. And that could have had something to do with this year's election and the number of recorded calls and other kinds of things that people were getting, but it's definitely a lesson I wanted to pass along. When we did have cell phone numbers, we got better answer rate, but with the, you know, caller ID and everything else that people have, they just don't answer the phone. And another super important lesson that we learned was that we really needed our coalition of groups, all those organizations that I told you about who participated with us. It was a lot of work. So we were glad we had a lot of staff folks involved. And finally, in closing, I would just like to let all of you know that the project work, the restoration projects, and the levy that passed in Blaine County really could not have succeeded without the people power that we had in place. And the people power can't be underestimated in terms of the future success of levies in Idaho like ours to fund conservation or doing on-the-ground restoration work. It connects people to what we do and the natural areas and resources that we are working to protect. And I can't emphasize enough how beneficial this is to our mission as a land trust and to the future of our county. You see here one of our restoration projects here, planting happening on Earth Day in 2005, and then the recent restoration work at the Croy Wetland area. People planting trees, just getting dirty, getting their hands out there involved with the work. And all of this connects people to the land and the projects. It can also be valued at a certain dollar figure per hour and help you leverage that state funding. So don't underestimate how much you can charge for a troop of Boy Scouts on the ground planting some trees. It's a good thing. And during our campaign to pass the levy, we involved 60 volunteers outside of our, you know, staff members for our organization, our ballot committee. And some of those folks may, in fact, end up sitting on the Citizens Advisory Board and be connected to those future projects that are completed with levy funding. So it's an investment of staff time with many, many benefits, and I think that it leads to better land conservation over time. It adds to the work we do with private landowners through conservation agreements, and it provides our organization with more visibility in the community with which to let people know about the important effects of floodplain, river, and land conservation.
That was Catherine Goldman. Catherine's the Senior Project Coordinator at the Wood River Land Trust in Haley, Idaho. The Wood River Land Trust is on the web at www.woodriverlandtrust.org. Installment number 3 on this Earth Day show, Deb Branting took a break on Earth Day 2010. That was April 22nd. She was hosting a booth for the Idaho Women in Timber at the LC Recyclers Earth Day celebration in Lewiston, Idaho. Among other things, the women in timber were helping kids to make paper at their booth. Deb Branting works at the Clearwater Paper Plant in Lewiston and is the president of the state chapter of Women in Timber.
I'm Deb Branting. I'm the president of Idaho Women in Timber.
And so you're president of the whole...
The Idaho chapter. And we also consist of local chapters. Like here in Lewiston, we have the LC chapter. Yeah. And we also have chapters in Bonner's Ferry. We had one in Elk City. They no longer have one after the mill closed up there. And we have in Coast Falls also have a chapter.
Yeah.
And we're also part of what's called Federated Women in Timber, and that would be the various states here in the U.S.
Are you mostly an outreach group?
Yeah, we're about education. We believe that the wise management of our forests allows us to have a healthy forest products industry while at the same time having a quality environment. But it all depends on that wise management of the forest.
Yeah.
So we're about education. We talk to kids like we're doing here with the kids at the Earth Day event. We talk with our local people who are in political arenas, well as resource agencies, and then at the state level. And then once a year, Federated, all the states get together and go to Washington, D.C. and talk to our lawmakers there and resource agencies about different topics that have to do with the forest industry and our forestry management.
Now, when I just read your brief summary here, it says that the women, the members are women who, let me just read it, directly or indirectly, your livelihood is related to the forest products industry. So what kind of composition would you say the members are? I'm assuming probably when it started it was mostly wives of men who worked in mills.
Right,
now it's
right.
Probably
it's
much more balanced.
It's more women who are actually working in the industry now. As far as members who are, you know, simply a wife of somebody who works in the industry, that's not so much.
Yeah. And may I ask, what do you do?
I am a process technician for Clearwater Paper.
Yeah.
I work for the tissue products division.
Is that job like chemistry or more mechanical?
Basically, the chemistry of tissue making.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do a lot of testing on what we see here, the slush.
Oh, yeah.
And finished products as well.
So I was asking her as we were doing the paper making if this is just a simplified version of it really goes
it
on
is.
In the factory, too.
It is a very simplified version.
But what's the some of the initial material that goes in? What's the cellulose fiber or whatever material
that we're using
in,
right here?
No, in the real world.
In the real world, it would be cellulose, hemicellulose. Basically, that's
from,
what it is.
From wood
chips.
From wood chips.
Mm-hmm. Basically, it starts as a chip. They pulp out what's called lignin. Lignin is what holds the wood fibers together.
Uh-huh.
And they pulp out the lignin and some extractives. And so some of the hemicellulose goes with that. And so you end up with mostly cellulose, partial hemicellulose.
Yeah.
And then you go through the process of bonding that together into a sheet.
Okay. And what kind of background do you have to be able to do this? Did you have to go to school forever and ever?
I have a business administration degree, and I have a master's in organizational leadership. And I'm doing paper chemistry, you know?
It's about having a brain, right?
Yeah, it's about having a brain.
Well, let me ask you something that I'll verge on touchy. Do you get a lot of crap from people saying that women in timber are, you're the ones cutting the trees? And from environmentalists, get crap?
We don't really too much. We really don't. Because we're about forestry management, and they are also, people in the environmental community are also about forest management. So we kind of understand each other in that sense.
Yeah.
But we, as far as cutting trees, we understand that you still have to cut trees. You know, we're a renewable resource.
So. As long as we just don't overuse it.
Yeah, and definitely replant.
Yeah.
That's the key
to
it.
Yeah, well, I see what you're doing here today. I mean, you've got the trees, you've got seeds, the displays are all about management.
Right.
And how much of it we use, so how can we continue to do that? We got to keep planting and we got to manage.
Right.
Those are the kind of messages you work with?
Definitely.
Do you get in on more detail level too? I mean, obviously paper making, but...
When we're in Washington, D.C., sometimes we do end up having to get into more detail.
Sure.
But as far as our members knowing exactly, you know, everything about planting a tree and how it grows and all that, that's really not expected. It's just the basic premise of understanding the whole management process and how that contributes to sustainability.
Could you tell me if there's any one or two major issues that are the most pressing for either education or legislation that you're dealing with now?
Basically just that the understanding that a tree is renewable. I mean, we get the don't cut trees, but what they don't understand is that that resource is renewable, and we can use it as long as we replant. That's one of the biggest issues. And dealing and teaching children as well as adults.
We're consumers in this society. We don't realize what the sources are of the things we use.
Yeah, there are so many things that we don't, that people just don't realize. Parts of the tree can be used to make, like toothpaste for one, the cellulose. Cellulose is used in making shampoo. Twinkies have cellulose in them. As well as all those other ones, that, the other things that we, you know, we know, the board and all that.
Those are the obvious
our homes.
Ones.
And bathroom tissue, yeah, the obvious ones. Yeah. You know, just understand that our premise is that trees are renewable. They're a renewable resource, and if we continue to manage that well, we'll have that resource for forever.
Okay, thank you very much, Deb.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Deb Branting, she's the president of Idaho Women in Timber. Check out the Women in Timber website at www.womenintimber.org. Can you live without your car? Can you even get to work, get groceries, get your kids to and from school on foot or on bike? Maybe if you live in a really small town, you can, or if you live in an old city that grew up neighborhood by neighborhood. There's a movement across the country to make that possible with today's growing development. And the goals are to make modern life simpler, cheaper, and cleaner. Smart Growth is the name of that movement. Elaine Clegg is a member of the Boise City Council. She's been on the council since 2003. And she has worked for 25 years on growth management issues. She's been Idaho's Smart Growth Project Director since the late 1980s, and now she's working on special projects for Idaho's Smart Growth Project. Consequences of Infill Development is one of her projects that you can find on the Idaho Smart Growth website. At the 2008 Idaho Environmental Summit, Elaine Clegg talked about the policies that cities, counties, and states can create that will encourage smart growth. And she has some examples of Idaho cities that have tried these policies out. She starts her presentation by answering the question, just what is smart growth?
Smart growth is connected. Mixed uses, sprawl is not. So that's the main idea about smart growth. It isn't no growth. Part of the problem with why we have to think about smart growth is land use policy. And there's two features of land use policy that have helped generate this urban sprawl that we see everywhere. One of those are regulations that isolate uses. We isolate uses by, you know, what are they? If it's residential, it can only be here. If it's commercial, it can only be there. The other one, really, I think, one that I've worked a lot on is transportation policy that's aimed at providing automobile access. And in doing that, it extends access to increasing expanses of land and really supports that low-density growth pattern that we've seen all over the place. If you don't have very good access to it, it's pretty hard to put 1,000 houses out there. But if you build a big road, then, gosh, that means that it's open, right? Another thing that we looked at in starting this project was really what is the biggest issue that we face. And LEED and D, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is a set of principles based on LEED principles for neighborhoods and not just for buildings. And within those, one of the most important, and in fact a prerequisite for almost anything, is location. In order to be considered a LEED neighborhood, you either have to be an infill site, you have to be near adequate transit service, you have to be near neighborhood shop services and facilities so you can walk to those if you don't have adequate transit, or these are and or in locations where your regional metropolitan planning organization can prove through performance measures that this location will be will reduce vehicle miles traveled over other parts of the region because of its, you know, proximity to shops and services, or its proximity to transit, or its proximity to planned ones of those. So location is really the first prerequisite. But a really interesting study called the Growing Cooler Report showed that if you do build these kinds of smart growth communities, it really does reduce the vehicle miles traveled. Another piece of this, we have a changing demographic in this country. We are going to grow. We already have 58 million large lot detached homes in this country, which is 23 million more than we need in 2050 or in 2030. We don't have enough attached. We don't have enough small lot. So we've already got an oversupply, and this is research done by Arthur Nelson, who is a professor at
University of Utah now.
Oh, he's at the University of Utah now. Wow, he's close. I didn't realize he was so close. Just looking at the demographic shift that we're facing. Many of you probably don't realize that the city of Boise already today has a household size smaller than 1.9. So it's already starting. All of the cities around here are seeing much smaller household sizes than they've seen in the past. The smart growth developments that we toured yesterday, the real estate folks said, guess what? Who's buying here? Singles. Singles and married couples or other partners who, you know, only have a two-person household. That's the demographic that's out there, and it's coming. So the Smart Growth Best Practices project is based on those 10 principles of smart growth. It identifies the principles and then related policies and regulations that could be used to implement those principles, and then identifies examples of those regulations in use in Idaho. Principle number one is to provide those transportation choices. When you do this, you reduce auto dependency, and you create the ability for people to choose to do something other than drive their car. Right now, everyone says, well, you know, nobody in Idaho will get out of their car. It's pretty hard to get out of your car if everything is 5 miles away. You can't bike, you can't walk, and there's no transit. So if we don't provide the choices, then people won't get out of their car. So policies and regulations that we've identified that might help people do this. So transportation improvement programs, which, if you're part of MPO, is a requirement. If you design those well, they can help. Bicycle and pedestrian elements in your comprehensive plans can make those a priority. You can utilize technology on transit that helps people use that more easily. You can create comprehensive bicycle and pedestrian plans. You can adopt a connectivity index. Not a lot of people know about this. We're working on one here where you take the number of intersections, the number of segments of road, and the square miles, the area that you're covering, and it has to reach a certain number or you don't have enough connectivity. So what you want is short road segments and lots of intersections, lots of connections, and then you can get anywhere very easily. And then always you need to consult with emergency responders when you do this, but our experience has been when you do that, they end up becoming supportive. So an example of this in practice in Idaho is a comprehensive bicycle and pedestrian program plan that the Ada County Highway District has adopted. We all like to beat up on ACHD, but they've actually done awfully good work in this area. In 1991, the Americans for Disabilities Act required that transportation districts comply, and ACHD in, I think, the year 2000 undertook a GIS survey of all of their pedestrian bicycle facilities in the whole county. It includes 1,400 center line miles of sidewalk or pathway, and it identified every place on a sidewalk where it didn't comply with ADA for either, you know, the curb cut or it was too narrow. Anyway, so they've done this for the whole county. Out of that, they prioritized a bicycle network. And they also have prioritized a sidewalk network based on school sites. And they decided that their first priority would be safe routes to school and being able to provide kids with the ability to walk to school. This is available online at ACHD if you'd like to learn more about it. It's something that wouldn't be nearly as onerous for a smaller community to undertake as ACHD, and they could provide you, I think, with a lot of information and experience about how to do that. They actually went out with handheld GPS units. They hired a bunch of interns and walked the sidewalks and noted with the GPS what was happening at a particular site, and since it was GPS, that it just created the map for them. Anyway, it's a great project. The second smart growth principle is create a mix of land uses. Again, when you do that, then the neighborhoods are more walkable. You can shop and work and recreate close to home. Even if you do drive, the trips are shorter. When you do walk or bike, it's healthier. All of this takes trips and miles off the road, and that improves air quality, lowers transportation costs, also conserves energy. So policies and regulations, some of those that we've identified that help with mixed use are comprehensive plans that actually envision mixed use nodes, sub-area plans within your city so that if you're a big city like Boise, you don't just have one mixed use node, you have many. Specific plan ordinance, and I'll talk about that in a second. Zoning codes often today don't allow mixed use, so you need to update those perhaps. Allow neighborhood-sized commercial within residential areas. Adaptively reuse. Sometimes we have schools or other what used to be governmental buildings, and so we have more ability for the government to help adaptively reuse those. An example, this in practice, is the city of Boise adopted what's called a specific plan ordinance, and under that ordinance, a developer and or the city can design a new plan for a specific area as small as 2 acres, as large as Harris Ranch was 1,700 acres. And with that plan ordinance, you get to write your own zoning code. And so if you have something that you want, you can use the city's code as your basis, but if you have something that you want to do differently, you can write that into the plan. Once the plan's adopted, then when you go to pull your permits, that's in code, and all of that is already done. So Harris Ranch used this new tool. They were the first one who used it. They created this great mixed-use area. Within that mixed-use area, they have very specific design guidelines and administrative procedures that are different from the city's other code. And within those procedures, once they go to develop, say they're going to develop these two blocks, all they have to do is get a subdivision plat, and off they go on those two blocks. They don't have to go through the design review process. They don't have to go through a new CUP, even though the streets are narrower and the setbacks are different than our regular zoning code. They've done all of that with the big specific area plan. So it's a real nice tool to use to get the kind of development you want. If you're doing a big enough development, it can be very well worth it. Number three is a range of housing types. Diverse housing products where you can live close to your friends and family throughout your life, no matter what your needs change. You can also that can also mean that you can make affordable housing for your workforce much easier than if you just have large lot single family. So there's a host of policies and regulations that you can use to implement this, including requiring it in your zoning code, providing incentives, working regionally to create a fair share housing program so that each community in the region has to take their fair share of the affordable housing. Eagle can't say, no, we only want large lot, expensive houses. You guys get all the multifamily. That could be a really important thing to do. In the Bay Area, particularly all over California, but Bay Area is using it the most, they're actually using transportation funds to incent housing near transit. And because it's federal funds, it has some requirements for affordable housing and mix and these things. And then also some tax incentives are available. An example of what you can do is Garden City. They just adopted a new city code. And within that city code, There's a group of different things that were never in Garden City's code before. There's a neighborhood commercial node overlay district. There's a transit-oriented development district. There's a green boulevard corridor. Right now, Chinden Boulevard, for those of you who are familiar with it, is pretty much a what we'd call a traffic sewer. It's a lot of pavement and not much else. As that redevelops, because of this plan, it will redevelop with landscaping and biofiltration, drainage, and all kinds of things that will help it become a much better place. They have a mixed-use overlay, and they have a sustainability provisions, which actually incent developers. If you're building something that you can prove through a measurement reduces VMT, then they'll forgive some of their permit fees. So it's a very innovative code. Although the code wasn't adopted yet when the waterfront district was developed, this is a district that is at the end of 36th Street on the river. Many of the provisions in the code were sort of tested in this waterfront district. They knew that the code was coming up, and they allowed this developer to help them test some of those provisions. It's got a mix of uses. It's got a little commercial center, some single-family housing, some live-work, some townhouses. And the good news is it's actually, much of it is actually built except for the commercial center. This wouldn't have been impossible had Garden City not been interested in changing their zoning. Under the code that Garden City had previously, this simply wouldn't have been legal. Walkable neighborhoods are very important. You need safe sidewalks. You also need somewhere to walk to. You need safe routes to school. If you do have these, they're healthier and they save energy costs. Being walkable means a number of things. If you have buildings that are closer to the street, it's more interesting to walk along there because there's something to see as you're walking and maybe neighbors to talk to. If you have trees between the sidewalk and the street, it shades the sidewalk, it protects the pedestrians from the traffic, can provide biofiltration for the runoff from the street. Bike lanes are very important. Parking along the street can also do the same thing as trees, protect the pedestrians. So those are the kinds of regulations, things that encourage that are the kinds of regulations that we'd like to see for more walkable neighborhoods. So adopt complete streets policies. A couple of places around Idaho are working on that. Nobody's adopted one yet. Safe routes to school programs, which I mentioned. There's a federally funded, state-run grant program that allows participants, if they win the grant, to actually build sidewalk and other things that help with safe routes to school. One example of a place in Idaho that's I think gone beyond what most, especially small cities, have done is Sandpoint and their city pedestrian sidewalk standards. Within those standards, they have a maximum slope that the sidewalk can be. They have a minimum width. They have a requirement for a detached sidewalk if it's other than in a commercial area. And if it's in a commercial area, then the width becomes wider. They have particular standards for how the sidewalk gets built so that over time it stays level, and they also have a requirement for curb cuts at all of the corners. Encourage community stakeholder communication. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to hurry through these. You can identify shared values, you can strengthen the community spirit, and work collaboratively so that you don't end up being enemies. There's, again, a number of policies and regulations that you can use. The one that we chose as the example was strong public participation for planning processes. Compass in this region, which is the Metropolitan Planning Organization, in their most recent long-range transportation plan, used a lot of community input to develop what's called Communities in Motion. If Communities in Motion actually gets implemented, it will save 47,000 acres of land from being developed and a million miles a day of travel. And it has good community support because it was a collaborative planning process. Foster distinctive, attractive places with a sense of place. Matt said, you know, we were driving down Overland yesterday. It could have been anywhere USA. Well, anyone who knows Boise knows that that represents Boise. And so iconic buildings can be a great way to do this. There are other ways as well. And one of those is to develop public gathering places, also perhaps iconic gathering places. Caldwell's embarked on just such an effort. This was what they planned to do in downtown Caldwell, to uncover Indian Creek and make it a great place again. And if you've been in downtown Caldwell, you know that it's made a tremendous difference already in what kind of place that is, and really provided Caldwell with us with a new sense of place. Predictable, fair, and cost-effective development decisions. These are mostly done in code, and there are some examples of that in Idaho, not a lot yet, but folks are working to establish different kinds of things in their zoning codes to make this work. We talked about Garden City already. Another very small example, City of Moscow has a green building program. And if you meet their qualifications as a green builder, then they forgive your permit fees. And this was a way for them to encourage green buildings in their city, and it's worked pretty well. Preserve open space, farmland, natural beauty, critical environmental areas. We haven't done a very good job of that as we've sprawled all over the landscape. A couple of places in Idaho are working to do better. There's a lot of different ways you can do that, but one of those is to develop, you can support local agriculture, but just even identifying what those highly valued spaces are is a really important factor. And Ada County has just recently undertaken an effort to do just that. They created the Ada County Open Space Advisory Task Force. In that task force, they created a report that recommends that looked around and said, you know, there really are already a lot of policies, but nobody's implementing them. So let's get to work on implementing. That's basically what the task force says. But it also says that all of the open spaces that already exist aren't connected. So let's figure out a way to connect them. Direct development toward existing communities, you know, taking an old building like this and making it a great new place. There's a lot of ways to work on infill development, a lot of different policies. One of the best that we've seen so far is the City of Boise, actually in partnership with ACHD and the regional transit system, created a corridor plan for State Street. The first implementation phase of that was to create design guidelines for how you would do transit-oriented development along that corridor. And you know, what that might look like in the future. Again, it's available online if you want to know more about it. And then finally, compact building patterns and efficient infrastructure. How do I do this? Somebody call out to me what they think, how many dwelling units per acre that building is. You may have a guess. Is it 10? Is it 15? How many dwelling units per acre? What's that? It's 86. Would you hate to have that in your neighborhood? Maybe, maybe not. Most people who live in that neighborhood actually really like it today, even though they were very scared of it when it was being proposed because it was so high density. So density is an interesting thing, and we need to get over the word and figure out how to make it work. There are a number of ways. Victor did, in fact, adopt this TND overlay district, and there is a development that's working to use it. That this is a mixed-use building that will have retail shops living all in one, and it's using that overlay district as its underlying zoning.
Being able to walk, bike, being able to shop right in your neighborhood, having a greener, cleaner place to live, those are some of the basics of smart growth. Elaine Clegg is a smart growth expert with Idaho's Smart Growth Project and is a member of the Boise City Council. One last little piece of input today comes from Dr. Tracy Craig, who sees feminism enter into surprising facets of our thoughts. Tracy teaches psychology at the University of Idaho. While teaching a new class, she gained insights into how men and women relate to nature in very different ways.
This semester, I've actually been teaching a new course in environmental psychology, and it's been really interesting to see gender differences in that course in terms of how men and women respond very differently. So one of the assignments they were doing is to, I call them the elemental assignments. So they're supposed to go sort of get into a space where they're interacting with earth, wind, air, fire, and talk about what does that bring up for them, how do they see themselves in relation to that. And men seem to see themselves as much more agentic in that, in the way that they relate to the elements, whereas women see it as something that's impacting them. And so,
I don't know the word you used.
Elements?
No, agentic.
Oh, agentic, okay. Meaning that they see themselves as in control or having control over it. So when they see, for example, I had one student who wrote about sitting by a stream and seeing that stream as, oh, he could build a dam and irrigate a field next to it. And a woman sort of really, sitting by a body of water and talking about how it brought her peace and comfort and this sort of thing. So just a really different relationship. I haven't explored that in my research, but it's certainly been a way in which I see feminism entering into that course as well.
I'm wrapping up this Earth Day themed Yin Radio show with music from Sa Re Ga Ma. This piece is called Water. Glad you could join me for this Earth Day show on Yin Radio. You can catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive updates about the program or to make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.